see. I would say that the meeting in New Orleans I'd have to look it up.
Okay.
But anyway, the thing about it was we took over the meeting and there were some brothers who were working with the whites. So they only come to our caucus to go back to the whites. And we knew the guy was doing. He never picked up the fact we knew he was a Tom. And we presented our position and we said, you can ask questions, but you cannot evaluate. You can ask questions of clarification, like what does motherfucker mean? Right. But don't tell us that we shouldn't do this, we shouldn't. This is our program. And then we made a plan for a meeting in Washington with the upper bound staff in the Department of Education, right there and then at the meeting. And we showed up in Washington. And I actually have letters in my files from colleges across the country who thanked us for bringing that to their attention, because they would never hire a black guy. But I'm not sure what kind of blacks they got, because I would say from the community control movement here in Harlem, the biggest weakness was the black staff that we got jobs for. They never, like the ones in Harlem who became principal, not one of them has ever thanked me. The Puerto Ricans have thanked me, Italians have thanked me, because see, the Jews and the Irish had a lock on the exam process, you know. Most of the principals were male Jews and female Irish. And so, you know, some Puerto Ricans got in, some Italians got in. See, one of my mentors was Dr. Leonard Cavello, who was the principal of Ben Franklin High School. Now, Ben Franklin had a basketball team that for 3 years won the PSAL. Sonny Woods, Eddie Younger, a guy named John Wilson, another guy named Jerome Bailey. The other guy is an artist now out in Levittown. Forgot his name. But anyway, for 3 years in a row, they won the citywide championship. And Bobby Wanzer, I don't know if you ever heard of him, played with Rochester. He was the sixth man for 3 years. That's right. And yet, when the NBA started, you know, they had no life. And
you were at Columbia for 10 years, then you
after I left East Harlem, I went to Columbia, and when I left Columbia, that's when I came to I worked planning Medgar Evers about 2 years, I guess, you know. And Medgar Evers would never hire me. I mean, people hired me on a part-time basis, but they were, you know, the West Indians were taking over various departments, and they had this colonialized kind of education, and
did you?
They didn't have a warrior mentality, and what is embarrassing to me, I left a white institution and went to a Negro institution, and they were afraid of me. I mean, it was sad. You know, I mean, it says something about
This was in the mid '60s, or that this was in the '70s.
That was late 60s, early 70s. Because, see, my last class at Columbia, and I'll send you a copy of the report. I did a paper on it, this is somewhere. Was a class at Hamilton Hall. with Bill Sales, Sam White, a whole bunch of young guys. The guy whose father was a lawyer in Newark. He defended Baraka when Baraka got arrested.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they're all in my class. And I assigned them to various groups in the community, like the Panthers, Wallace, Democrats. In fact, they could not get into Wallace's club. He said, we don't want you. Nope, we don't know any volunteers. And one guy sent back to his community to organize a political Boy Scout. He almost got run out of his own community. I said, man, don't come here. That's all my non-racism and so forth, man. I'm the Boy Scout. And and one of the things I dug up that they, you'll see in this paper, I'll have to mail it to you, that the white man is the original Uncle Tom. I got that out of Organization Man. That was my analysis. And by the way, the students agree with me, and they thank me for it. You'll see in this paper. And I even got some of the Jews who had never lived in a Jewish community because they were like the military and so, to get in touch with their own culture, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the most exciting part at 68, see, every night I was there with the students in Hamilton Hall, because that's where my class was, and so that's where Bill and those guys took over the building. And like the elevator operator, my brother, as soon as I hit the elevator, he'd take me up to my class. When I came out, he'd come down first and then go back to, and this white guy standing there. They would never say a word. And then there were some, the students felt that if they, the SDS, Students for African American Society, and the student body organization, which are mainly liberals, and they could come together in one group, they could take over the whole thing. Because every day, guys wearing yellow ribbons, pink ribbons, the administration sent them out there. I'll never forget the president saying to Mark Rudd, why are you so political? Mark Rudd said, you guys are political. God, shut up. And anyway, so I would meet with each group once a week. And I wish I had a tape recorder and a video then. The funny thing about it, the liberals would always ask me, what did the radicals say about them? What did Mark Rudden say? They don't mention you guys. The meeting went in. Because they only came to find out, you know. And I used to go up on Saturday morning with the SDS. The SDS was the youth group for the League for Industrial Democracy. Wyatt Rustin, Michael Harrington. And every time we'd go up on Saturday, about 4 a.m., I'd get a call from some board member. I don't know what other guys. He knew me. Listen, will you look out for communist literature? You know, I never did, but they would always call me and ask me, bring back any communist literature. And he's just supposed to be the far left, you know what I mean? And, but, you know, I took my kids with me. They enjoyed it. And
so where did you work after Columbia?
I'm trying to think. Damn. Listen. For a while I did some guest stuff at MedGabbers. Oh, so we had developed a reading program, which ought to be used, where the parent reads the instructions into a tape recorder and the child carries it out. We were using it in the prisons throughout New Jersey, where the fathers and mothers in the joint would make a tape, we'd take a tape into the home. Of course, they sent other messages and so forth. Very successful program. Every kid we sent into public school was reading. And but it was too threatening. if you ask me, because too successful. Mm-hmm. It was tested by ETS, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to figure out what the hell I did after Columbia. I did something. Oh, you know, I set up AFRAM, 1968, and we developed a parent decision-making educational model.
What was the idea when you set up AFRAM?
What?
What is AFRAM?
It's an educational research corporation. And over the years, we've done a lot of writing, done research, evaluated educational program. We evaluated Baraka's Africa Free School, evaluated the Massachusetts Educational Special School up in Boston. But the main thing, we developed this parent education model, decision making, where we put parent decision making on the national follow through map. And we had programs in 9 cities in 5 states, Little Rock, Michigan, Boston, and ended up in Washington, D.C. And I don't know if you knew Ken Haskins.
Yeah.
Well, you know, yeah. Ken was really my best friend. You know, and he ran the principal center up at Harvard. And tremendous guy, man. And he died of cancer. Mm-hmm. And the guy who developed the reading program, Greg, also died of cancer. I'm just wondering why the hell they left me here. And
well, let me ask you this. From that time till now, what has been your main activity?
I would say archiving, getting information around the country, and serving my people. Since I've worked with public housing tenants, worked with parents, I've been active with some neighborhood groups, you know. And I would say that I have a problem with a lot of neighborhood groups because they're bullshitting, you know. And so I used to have something I call a bullshit test. I'd send it to people. And I remember some guy wrote to me from California. Like, a lot of guys send me information about their doctoral dissertations. We've had 2 doctorals done here, one on community control and one on the New York Renaissance, which is coming out soon. And the one on community control, I'll make sure you get a copy of it. A sister up at Harvard did it. You know. Which reminds me, when Kim was at Harvard, one of his students wanted to do a doctoral dissertation on my work. And a brother up there, forgot his name, you probably know him, wouldn't let her do it.
Martin Kielsen?
Huh?
Kielsen?
Nah, I knew Nielsen. I was on a panel with him. This guy was at Syracuse at first. Because when he was at Syracuse...
Oh, you mean, I know who you mean.
Because his daughter just did a study comparing the black college experience with the white colleges. Anyway, see, my daughter was at Syracuse when he was there. And as far as I was concerned, he was bad news. And when he got to Harvard, he wouldn't let this student, whom I knew well, do a study on me.
What was your first experience in a library?
Say that again.
Your first experience in a library.
Yeah, good question. Man, tell me. I would say when I was at City College, I did a paper on the, it's a second year course leading to bachelor's in science, where in addition to the scientific analyses, I use poetry, I use examples from novels and so forth. And I use the library a lot then. And after I handed the paper in, one day I'm walking in the library, three faculty are going there checking out my paper. Because they didn't believe it. And what I did, I just followed them around, found out what books they checked out. They checked out every one of the books that I footnoted. Because they didn't believe I could make that kind of connection. And but also the Du Bois experience. And when I read all of Du Bois' stuff, and I realized in my own, from my own perspective, that he probably would not recognize and practice a lot of the theories he talked about. And then I was educated a lot by people in the community. Like, I'll never forget one day, a guy who's dead now, who'd been in the joint, he said to me, I'm going to walk down the street and I'm going to show you where every guy's been in the joint. And I couldn't, you know, I would have guessed that maybe five people, at least 20 people. He just gave me a little signal. He knew right away that they'd been in the joint. And he also taught me something else. He said the best time to intervene into a guy's life is when he commits a second crime. Because the first crime he can commit, made a mistake, man. Family said, well, he never been in trouble before. And the parole officer said, man, I never seen him before. You know. But second time, the guy said, man, maybe something wrong with me. And the parole officer said, here come that motherfucker again. And the mother said, uh-huh, we got to get on his behind. And I shared this with a lot of parole officers. But see, they're not into the life of the people.
Have you ever known other black archivists like yourself in the community or in a library?
Oh, yeah. Good question. I'm trying to think who they are. I never met Van Zee, but I remember when they found his stuff, Ken Clark found it. So, I'm aware of that. I do know others. I'm just trying to...
Well, I mean, you...
Well, that's amazing. I can't think
but
of...
But early, you... When did you first go to the Schomburg?
I'm pretty good. When they hired a white guy as the archivist, so we picketed. I have pictures of the pickets. And in fact, that's how Howard got there. We ran a guy named Wendell Ray out. He went back to the University of Pittsburgh. And one day I heard him and John Clark on the radio, and he trashed Clark for even raising the question about a white archivist. And see, by the way, I wasn't against a white archivist, but I felt if he's white, we ought to check him out and he ought to be able to sit and talk. But he would, every time I'd walk into Schomburg, he'd run. And
but you had been in the Schomburg before that.
I'd been there, but not extensively.
What about...
I knew...
Gene.
The curator. Gene Hudson. And because we used to have lunch together at 22 West, 135th Street. And Dr. Anna Arnold Hedgman was there practically every day. And another guy from NAACP was there. So we'd have nice discussions. And a guy named Bennett, who organized the national movement to establish a Martin Luther King holiday. He took 6 million signatures to Washington. I have a picture of it somewhere.
Just a second.
I didn't mention Mississippi.
No.
See, every year I would take my students.
From Columbia?
Yeah. In fact, I'm glad I got this. So I wrote the think piece on the community control movement at Columbia. Now, there have been an earlier piece suggesting that we change the curriculum to include African history and so forth. But I added a piece about we should run all the principles out our own principles. And Columbia was getting so many calls, they hired another secretary, but they didn't tell me. I found out later, this new person sitting over there, and one day she asked me, do you have any papers on your community control movement? Yeah. She said, can you put them on a table? I said, sure. I come there one day, there's maybe 8 guys from around the country, Northwestern, Harvard, yeah, reading this stuff. But they never told me that they were getting these many inquiries. And what it made me think about is that they still don't want us to control ourselves. And that's what most of us have come to conclude now.
So, did you ever meet Malcolm?
Oh, yeah. See, in 1963, one of the black faculty invited Malcolm to do a workshop on human relations, you know, at Columbia. And, by the way, I'm going to send you a statement that a white boy did who met Malcolm at a camp, in camp for citizenship upstate. And I published it. Make a note to make sure I sent it to you. But, because I sent it to Spike Lee for him to have some impression of Malcolm's ability to deal with white folks in a non-hostile way, whatever you want to call it. And, but he didn't use it. Because he had a best interest in the other thing. But anyway, I'll never forget, when Malcolm walked in, he had a fruit of Islam with him. So he sat down, and they brought him some tea. He passed the tea to the fruit of Islam. Fruit of Islam tasted, passed it back to him. No discussion, just did it. It was beautiful. I mean, it was just, you couldn't have staged it better. It wasn't staged, by the way, it was real. Because he was checking that shit out for real. He's not going to trust him. Why should he trust him? And at one point, at the end of this presentation, first, most of the white faculty came back from all over the world from vacation, because it was at the end of the summer to be there. And most of the people had made up their mind they were going to be against what he said. And therefore, integration, which, and they didn't mean mutual, they mean subservience. You understand that. And every time they'd ask him a question, it was a double question. So he'd have to turn around and say, this question. And it was a brilliant presentation. Absolutely brilliant.
Was it taped?
It probably was, but you know, it was in the summer of 1963. You might write to them for it. You might be able to get it at the Columbia University School of Social Work. It's on 113th Street now. Because I've been intending, there was a black guy who called the workshop.
But is that the first time you met Malcolm?
Yeah, because I rode back to Harlem with him. And tried to explain to a lot of people, most people don't explain it, because most people see Malcolm as Messiah, which was wrong. Like, I'll never forget one woman who still misunderstood him. She said, Malcolm, Minister Malcolm, I'm going to follow you all the way. He said, no, come to your own conclusion. Come up with your own opinion. I don't think she understood that, because she still talked about him as Jesus. I think it was like meeting Jesus. And, see, my concern was that he might have seen me as a Tom, you know, come to Columbia. And, by the way, and that's happened to me in my life, you know, like some street brother will see me over on Columbia campus, think I sold out, you know, but Malcolm never treated me that way. And it was a brotherly experience. And I don't think I could explain it to most people, you know. But we rode all the way from 91st Street to 125th Street in his car. And we just talked, you know.
In the Oldsmobile?
The Oldsmobile, that's right. And I knew, that's funny, I knew a guy who later bought the Oldsmobile, you know. And that's something. See, very few people would mention that. Now the other thing I found out, see, when I ran the follow-through parent program, I hired Muslim sisters. And most people around would not hire Muslims, you know. Well, I would hire guys who had been on drugs who were trying to get off, you know. And one guy I hired, I said, if you can put this coat rack together, you got a gig. Took him about 2 days to do it, but he did it. You know? And now he's off the drugs, and he runs a drug program himself. But frankly, I was never sure if an ex-addict had outconned me. To my point. No psychiatrist can deal with it. I mean, they just make money off it, but they don't.
Yeah.
These guys are smart, man.
Tell me, when and why did you start the Malcolm X Lovers Network?
There was a brother in Indianapolis. You knew of him.
Omar.
What was his last name?
Farouk.
Yeah. For some reason, he and I started writing to each other and sharing information, and he suggested it. And I went from there, you know. And but I also felt that Malcolm had a special message if we could get it to people. See, I never understood why Malcolm joined the Nation, even though I understood what the Nation contributed to him. Understand that?
Mm-hmm.
That is,
Well, he had family in the Nation.
Yeah. But the guy was, you know, most of the guys I met in the Nation, even now, if I were to read something in the paper about him, they'd say, man, I can't touch that. They still won't talk about it. You know what I mean? Ben Chavis, you know, he got this whole thing with women. Nobody wants to talk to you about it. You know?
As you think of all the people you have met.
Say it again.
Of all the people you have met who have been interested in Malcolm, who are the people that you respect most?
You're one of them. You know. Omar's another one. I have a brother in Queens, Omar Shabazz. I don't know if you've ever met him, but he did several interviews on tape with Malcolm. Not with Malcolm, but with people around Malcolm.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, whenever he's up by the museum, he's in a trance, man. I mean, he just gets taken away. And I wish you could get a chance to see the museum, because it has a big mural and a lot of pictures taken by Higgins, you know, Malcolm's photographer. But they didn't have a picture of the Honorable Elijah. And I have questions about that. Because Honorable Elijah made a contribution, wasn't
sure, sure.
Whether
sure.
You know, respect it or not, you mean, if those guys out here now had been on drugs all those years, man, I'm trying to still deal with the question about Malcolm. Omar, Queen Mother, mm-hmm. he had tremendous respect for. I would say Baraka, Sonny Carson, Al Van, Jitu Wiyusi, and Percy. Percy Sutton, he's right down the street, by the way. He had a lot of respect for Malcolm. Charlie Rangel. Alice Cornegay, she's dead. She's an activist around here. In fact, she saw Malcolm at the March on Washington. Told me the next morning he was there. Because the people in Harlem knew where Malcolm was every minute. Because if they were on the east side, somebody would mention Malcolm just went that way. You know? It was amazing. I mean, how they knew where he was and what he was doing. Like, I'll never forget the day that the cops went into the mosque. There were helicopters flying over. So everybody started heading toward 116th Street. I walked from 131st to 116th Street. And I'll never forget when I got there, all these junkies, heroin junkies, were there. And they were getting straightened, man. They were standing straight. I mean, like, it was like it had an impact on them, you know. And I remember Farrakhan saying that the young kids in the school wanted to fight. Let us help out. And, you know, I don't know if you remember that book. One cop was killed when he went in there, you know. And they never were able to convict anybody else because they had no right going in there. But I'm sure there's some other people.
Sure.
I'd like to add their names because some of them were in Boston. I know people in Boston who knew them.
Who else has been collecting material like you?
Omar and the brother in Queens. Leave me that question. I'll have to.
Okay.
Cause I'll send you. Cause see, a lot of people send me information.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I got people in California mm-hmm. send me information. People in Atlanta send me information. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the information they send me, I would never be privy to, you know, mm-hmm. if they didn't send it to me.
Mm-hmm.
And see, Malcolm is the most talked about individual in the black community. I mean, he's quoted on every issue. Somebody will find something that Malcolm would have said if he was still living or did say, you know. And so, almost anything affecting black people,
mm-hmm.
His name comes up in some way, you know,
mm-hmm.
or people will make a reference to him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And like this guy, Meet Patty Fritz. Every time I see him, he's talking about Malcolm, and I'll never forget his statement. I would like to have had him as my son-in-law. Mm-hmm. That's the highest commendation a black man can receive, man, from another black man. and share my daughter, man. I'm kidding.
How many people do you know around now who knew Malcolm?
Oh, a lot of them. A lot of them. See, Malcolm suspended more people than any minister in the nation. Because he wasn't bullshitting. See, if you mess up in another month, they say, I'd sell more papers. Shine my shoes. Bring me a sister. So, the guys tell me that they'd, you know, con a sister, no, sister, you know, a dog out here, the brother out here, to walk sister home, end up in the bed. Sister, guy'd go off to sleep. 3 a.m., sister get on the phone, call Malcolm. Minister Malcolm, Brother Joe's over there, he's sleeping. Malcolm would come over and 3 a.m. in the morning, wake the dude up. And when he put you out of Moss, it was for a year and four. For a year, you could not come into the Moss. And for 4 years, you could never you couldn't get a leadership position. He had high standards, very high standards. And he took it serious that he had that he was trading out people. And by the way, so over the years, every now and then, some guy would ask me to write his letter to Honorable Elijah. In every instance, they were asking for external control. Stop me from beating my wife. Stop me from using drugs. So they wanted to be controlled by another source. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there's ever been a study of that kind of a personality. You might know. You know, I don't know, but that was one of the things I couldn't understand, because Malcolm didn't want anybody to control him, and he didn't want to control anybody else. Mm-hmm. So that must have been a very uncomfortable network for him, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget Farrakhan saying to me, once we were on a plane somewhere, that Malcolm made the mistake of getting closer to the Honorable Elijah than his own son. You know, a Cain-Abel thing, you know. And I always felt that Wallace sort of like set him up when he told him about the women. Because Malcolm was the heir apparent. Mm-hmm. You know, things are going along naturally. But when the thing came about the women, Wallace walked right in there, you know. And by the way, I had a lot of respect for Wallace in terms of his metaphysical approach, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, he changed the whole structure such that it wasn't top down, it was group up, you know. And when I was involved in planning Medicare with Color, that's a process we developed. Bill Berenbaum, who hired all of us, was like a little dictator. We said, nah, we will make the decisions and you ratify them. And by the way, we planned Medgar Evers as an independent college, an independent institution. Mm-hmm. We wanted to make it like a southern institution in the north, mm-hmm. but independent. But Bill Birnbaum sat down with one of the Kennedys, and before we knew it, it was a part, was project number 7. Mm-hmm. That's the 7, Malcolm's number, and that's mm-hmm. In New York City. And they'll never know how much that damaged them, you know, because they're sitting around waiting for money from both, rather than developing the way some of the black colleges develop themselves, you know, the black churches support.
Now, I want to try to put up a page, take 1 month to feature you and the material mm-hmm. on the website.
Okay. Yeah. And I'll send you some more stuff, by the way.
But we need to plan that.
Yeah, okay. Very good. I'd appreciate that.
And then we could also put all of that information on a CD.
Yeah.
CD-ROM.
Okay.
And that's even something that you can market and sell.
Okay, good. I need that. Okay, good. And so I'm going to go through myself because I don't sing you as much as I should, you know. One thing, I had a young guy come in because he wanted to use my office. He messed up my email. Yeah. And Sam is supposed to be working on it now. You know Sam White. And I've been trying to understand him for years. Because, you know, Bill Sales is out of New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Other guys are doctors, lawyers, and so forth, you know. And Sam's still walking on down the street. And no, he was married to a medical doctor, you know, that he met at Columbia.
Hmm.
I knew him. He had two kids. He came down to New York from Connecticut. And,
But look, wait a minute. Now, I'm getting ready to end this tape.
Uh-huh.
So I want to ask you, we've discussed your life history and your work with Malcolm.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, is there anything else you'd like to say to be part of this tape?
I'd like to talk about Mississippi. Because 63, 64, 65, I took students from Columbia to Mississippi. And we would never call them up. We just walk into Jackson and hang out wherever we could, to a church, this and that. And while we were there, they elected a guy named Walker to the state legislature because blacks had built a church in a community center in Holly Springs, but the whites would not sell them oil so they could heat it up. So they knew they had a problem. So they started putting 24-hour guard around the building. And we used that struggle as a way to save this election by. They elected the first guy to save the legislature. And then there was a guy from CORE who became the Democratic leader there in Mississippi. Because, you know, I went to Israel with Chuck Stone. Remember Chuck Stone?
Sure.
He's on University of North Carolina. Paul Parks from Boston. This guy from Set Free, and a couple other people. And while we were there, we visited the original Hebrew Israelites of Dimona. And you remember, on their way to Israel, they went through Liberia. And Liberia is a big part of our history, because Liberia was, you know, established by African Americans.
Sure.
Plus, when I was at Morehouse, they had students, when they graduated, they had a right to Liberia. Because some of them got killed in that previous revolution. Dogon, what's the guy's name? The guy who took over from the family that ran Liberia.
The guy who took over after Tubman.
Yeah, after Tubman.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, some of them were killed in his revolution.
Okay.
Some of the students from Morehouse. And so, you know, there's Liberia has been a part of it. And, So I worked in Mississippi those 3 summers, and that's where I met Cheney first time, right? And then one of the white students did a book on it, and I knew Schwerner was a student at Columbia when I was there, and Shirley Chisholm ran a daycare center where I was assigned to the student. And I'm trying to think what else there is. But I still feel that the community control movement was probably the most significant thing I was involved in, trying to educate black kids. And we still haven't achieved it, you know. But, and I do want to mention one of the privileges of my life, my kids. My son, David, has his own Xerox company down on 30th Street. And each year they outsell everybody else to get a free trip to Hawaii. And, you know, his area is from 14th to 42nd east of Fifth Avenue, which is maybe the second or third richest area in the community. And he's also into martial arts, and he also became a Muslim. He went, did his Hajj in Mecca on the same day when Khalid was funeralized here, February 24th. And so I know when I meet my grandmother, she's going to say, Preston, what happened, man? Didn't I raise you? Fire and brimstone Baptist, yeah, you done good. And then I have a daughter who's a lawyer, my first. She's a lawyer for Local 1199.
Beautiful.
The biggest union in New York City, hospital workers. You know. And then I have my third child who runs a youth program, Brothers and Sisters of Soul. And she just got the Harlem Renaissance Award from Abyssinia Hospital, Abyssinia Church, because the Abyssinia runs a school in Harlem. Mm-hmm. One of the few churches that are doing it. They run the Thurgood Marshall School, mm-hmm. 136th Street. Mm-hmm. And they now own what was Small's Paradise, where Malcolm used to work as a waiter there. Mm-hmm. And we were trying to get them to keep it as Small's, but they want to make a school out of it. And anyway, well, she won that award. She works with youth. And